Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Camille, a young woman that embraced a non-binary identity and went under the knife in 2020 to have top surgery, where doctors removed her healthy breasts. Only after addressing her physical and mental health issues, Camille realized that she had been a woman all along. She now works to bring awareness to detransitioners and alternative treatments for those struggling like she did. So Camille, thank you so much for taking time out of your day and chatting with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Callie.
Yeah. So if it's okay with you and you don't mind, I'd really like to just dive right in and let's start with your surgery. You had top surgery, was what they call it, in 2020. So let's start there. How long were you living as non-binary, and maybe define that term for listeners who don't understand what non-binary is? You know, how long were you living as non-binary before you had the surgery? And let's start there.
So I was living as non-binary starting back in 2016. So I had been, you know, I'd been living as non-binary since then, but I had had gender issues starting back in sixth grade. Hmm. And that was after I have some trauma around being a woman and my sexuality, and that stemmed from around that time. And so I started dressing masculine around then.
Okay.
So it's something that was kind of, I guess it was something that had been an issue for a while, even before 2016.
Gotcha. And in sixth grade, was that something that you really understood what it was, or was it just, okay, I don't really like being female and what that implies? And you had a traumatic experience, or your friend, from what I understand, had a traumatic experience around that time. And that's kind of, so were those terms things that you were familiar with, or was it more of just like a general, like, I just don't feel comfortable being a girl right now?
Yeah. So what had happened during that time, was that my dad was telling me how men his age talk sexually about girls my age, because he was trying to get me to dress more conservatively. And, you know, it wasn't like I was, you know, dressing provocatively or anything. It was just that, you know, it's like I was into limited too. So the fashion of the time. And I think too, it's like, you know, I think too, just like growing into a woman, I think it was just something that made him nervous. And he wanted to protect me and look out for me. And then, you know, my best friend had been raped by her brother around that time. And I remember the police came to talk to us in the school, and they went us, there was like an annexed building. We went into the building and we talked to them in the office, and it was a woman and a man cop, and they were very nice. They were very professional. And, you know, we talked to them, and I mean, she ended up going living in a different house afterwards. I mean, they did the right thing. It's just, the experience was traumatic. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, it ended up changing how I interacted with boys afterwards, because, before that, I mean, I would ask boys to the dance, and, you know, and then, you know, go up to a boy, say, hey, do you want to slow dance for this song or whatever? Like that was something I was never like, you know, anxious about. But then it's just like, when I got into high school, because there weren't that many boys in my class, there wasn't a lot to choose from. So when I got into high school, I just like, when I would talk to boys, it was like, you know, it's not the butterflies in the stomach. It was past that. It was like anxiety inducing, and it never stabilized, because I think that with most people, you get a little anxious around somebody you like because you like them. And for me, it was dysfunctional. Like, it wasn't a healthy anxiety around boys, for sure.
Did you ever get to talk to anyone, like therapist, about the experience that happened with your friend and then the feelings that you were feeling regarding boys and yourself?
I did. I talked to a lot of therapists. I think every therapist I talked to after that point knew what had happened with my friend. So because it was such a big event and I knew there was some gender stuff around it, like I didn't know exactly to what extent, but I knew that there was like, back then I would have like been like sexism or something, you know, mm-hmm. but, you know, that sort of thought process. But I think part of the issue was that with a lot of therapists and how people process things, the risk of doing something like talk therapy is that you re-traumatize yourself every time you're having to tell these stories. And I think what was happening was that I was probably just re-traumatizing myself, but I wasn't working through it because I found that working through like my physical health has actually allowed me to process the emotional issues that I've had. So I think that's an important component that's being missed out of all this.
So you go on to high school, you're having these anxieties, and then you go off to college, right? And then is that where really you start putting labels on things and start understanding or start being told what you're feeling, I guess, or talk us through that.
Yeah. So when I went to college, what had happened was that I was introduced to women's studies. Like I'd had some experience before because I read a book in high school that was a more feminist leaning book. So I actually had kind of the foundation. And so when I went into college, it was actually that sort of abstract thinking that comes with, you know, like with that sort of abstract thinking that goes with something like feminism was something that I was very naturally good at. And then also just, I already kind of had a little bit of that mindset, but that was when I was introduced to gender ideology and this idea that you can be non-binary, or which would be this third gender altogether. From my understanding, somewhere on the spectrum can be non-binary. Like the gender, like this kind of idea of a gender spectrum, and you can be on that, and that would classify as non-binary. Maybe it wouldn't, maybe that would just fall under gender fluid. So that's even a confusing thing, right? Like, I'm not even quite sure. I'm like, well, could it be non-binary? Could it be gender fluid? But, you know, this kind of like idea of like, you can be outside of the gender spectrum altogether, or you're like in the center of the gender spectrum. It was just this idea of not being a woman or a man mm-hmm. was really what I was introduced to.
So do you now think that gender is a spectrum, or that sex is male and female is a spectrum?
I don't. Like, I think that, you know, you're female, male, woman, man. That's like, when we look at biology, we only have two sexes. And I know there's even like people get frustrated around the idea of like separating, you know, gender from sex. But right. If we're going to like kind of go into just kind of like a basic idea of, you know, gender, there is like two sexes, right? Like, if we're going to go down to the basics, there are two sexes. You can't, because that was the bizarre thing about my surgery, was that it was approved, but there's actually no non-binary sex to transition to. Like, you're right. Not transitioning from one to the other. I was seeing something that was in between, and that doesn't exist. And yet my doctor, two mental health professionals, and my surgeon all approved of this. So right. It was very, very odd, because I'm thinking, I'm like, gosh, like there's nothing to transition to. Like that doesn't exist.
Right. You weren't trying to say you were a man. You were saying you were non-binary, which what is that? What does that look like? Do they have breasts? Right. Do they not? So you didn't take any hormones, right? Or no. Okay.
No, I did not. And I had no desire to take hormones. And I think that that's probably going to depend on the individual who thinks they're non-binary, whether or not they want to take hormones. And that's what's so bizarre about this, is that it is very custom. It's, I think that shapeshifter says it best when he says that it's like a designer surgery. And that's the odd thing, is that I never went into this thinking that this was designer. I just thought, well, this is going to help me. I have discomfort around my breasts and I want that discomfort gone. Like, this is going to resolve that.
And did it?
No. So, I mean, it's one of the weird things, because I remember at the time I had discomfort around my breasts and my hips.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, now it's just like my breasts just feel weird because it just, they're not really there. So it's just kind of like a weird feeling. But like the discomfort around my hips went away after I addressed my physical health issues. So that was what I needed all along, was to address the underlying issues and not to remove body parts.
Yeah. Yeah. And you did this as an adult, a consenting adult. And so does it worry you? I'm just thinking about the children who aren't adults, who are thinking that these types of surgeries that are being performed on children, like, are you concerned at all about that? Being an adult and someone who thought that this was going to help, realized it didn't help, and now regrets, I assume, the surgery. What are your thoughts on that?
I do think that part of it is, I mean, even as an adult, like, I have to live with this decision every day. But I do not think that the current informed consent model is legitimate. So there's that. I think that there's just so much wrong with it that it's not true informed consent. Mm. But I do think that if I can go through this as an adult, because that's the thing, is that they're saying that these kids are going to grow out of it. And I can tell you, as somebody who went through this and who was having gender issues even back when I was in sixth grade, I never grew out of it. And so that's what's deeply concerning, is that you have this idea of, well, these kids are going to grow out of it, and they're going to, you know, they're going to realize that they were never non-binary or, you know, trans, like a trans man or a trans woman, like, or trans girl, trans boy. I mean, it's like, what do you even say for kids, right? But that's deeply concerning for me, because, and I mean, when you look at Abigail Schreier's book too, that's what's happening, is that sometimes they grow up and then they don't transition out of it. So, and then, you know, it can take a couple of years. So what happened was that, you know, it took me a year and a half to realize that this was a mistake, like that this wasn't what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And what's sad is that, you know, sometimes it can take more. Like, I think that there was somebody, it's taken like 10 years and then they realize it was a mistake. Or sometimes people wake up from the surgery and they're like, what have I done?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they realize that this was never what they needed. And so it's deeply concerning, because we don't know, like, what's going on. There hasn't been enough studies on it. Like, nobody's really looking into this. But yeah, if I could, as an adult, make this mistake, a young girl could absolutely make the same mistake. So it's just, that's what really needs to be heard.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, because I want to make sure I understand this,
right,
is that you're concerned too, that folks are saying, okay, these young kids might outgrow this thought that they're born in the wrong body. And you're saying, no, that's actually not true. They might not outgrow it, but we still don't want to operate. We still don't want to give care that they can't take back, even if they don't grow out. Like, that shouldn't be the standalone argument. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, it's mostly what I'm saying. I think too, the other component of that is addressing the underlying health issues.
Yeah.
Because that's, and it's, I really see this as a failure of our medical system, because had, like I was saying, like, once I addressed my physical health issues, then my discomfort around my hips went away. Like, that was what I needed. And then I was able to come to terms with the trauma that had happened to me back in sixth grade. I'm like, I'm more confident. I can laugh at myself because I'm like, I do stupid things all the time. So that's important. And that was something I wasn't able to do. Like, I took myself too seriously. Mm-hmm. And so it's so important to have that foundation. And what doctors do is that they're like, well, just take a pill. And that's what was said to me all the time. And the thing is, I can't tolerate medications. Like, I've tried so many medications. The only one that worked for me was methylphenidate CD. And the problem with that is that I would get gum disease when I take methylphenidate CD because it dried out my mouth. Mm. And that for people who don't know, is a medication for ADHD. So I think that it's bizarre to me because doctors aren't really looking at the foundation. Like, they're not looking at diet, which is such a huge factor in all of this. And I know that I was a pescatarian since high school. So I think that that's what's made things worse. So I was just like, I wasn't eating other forms of meat. I was just eating fish. And so I wasn't getting the other nutrients from animal products. And, you know, since I can tell you, since I started eating meat again, I feel much better. Hmm. And yeah.
Yeah. So it's just really need a comprehensive look at what's going on, which is makes sense, right?
Right.
You know, and so you had the surgery and it sounds like you didn't really meet much resistance. You kind of said, I want my breast removed. It was easy to find. Talk us through how easy it was to find someone to do the surgery and operation and how easy that was. And then I'd like to hear if you had any complications or how things were after the surgery.
Yes. So what had happened was that I reached out to my doctor and I said, okay, I'm thinking about this top surgery and getting this top surgery for being non-binary. And he referred me to somebody who connected me with the two mental health professionals who approved of the non-binary top surgery. So they approved of it. There wasn't a lot of resistance. They knew about my friend. And then they sent me, like, I don't know how the surgeon came into play, but I talked with the surgeon and, you know, the surgeon knew what was going on. They knew I was non-binary. And then there wasn't any resistance along that line of, like, nobody pushed back on it. Mm-hmm. And then I got the surgery August 27th, 2020. So this was during COVID, which is kind of surreal because Medicaid considered it a medical necessity. So,
wow. Because then this was at a time when they were canceling elective surgeries, at least. I mean, I'm a nurse, and so I knew how our hospital was impacted. And, you know, if it wasn't like life or death surgery or really critical, you weren't having surgery because COVID was, you know, so it's interesting that, you know, your insurance or the hospital, this was high enough on the list that you were going to have surgery in the height of COVID.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that's kind of the thing too, is that what I find odd is that they consider these surgeries medical necessities, but they're also, there's like this kind of like, well, they're going to kill themselves if they don't get the surgery. And the problem with that and the issue I have with that and putting people under surgery is that that has a potential to make things worse because you're having somebody who's very dysfunctional already. And then you're doing this really invasive traumatic to the body. Like this is, I mean, you're removing, like my surgeon called my mom and I think that surgeons, like plastic surgeons can be a little off sometimes because she called my mom and she's like, she said something about like removing a pound of flesh off my body. And I was just like, that's just so weird. Like it's so disconnected from, yes, I actually removed healthy tissue from a human being like that. There's just sort of a disconnect there for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see what you're trying to say. I think that as an aside, like the fertility industry that kind of does the same thing around, you know, babies and like surrogates, they, you know, it's a journey. They kind of disconnect the process of being pregnant and bonding with a little one from the surrogacy journey, you know, journey. I'm using journey in quotes here, but, you know, so it seems like maybe you're kind of describing the same thing. It's like they're kind of calling it something else or using different words so that they're not as impactful. Interesting. So How was, did you feel like before the surgery that you were aware of any risks that you might undergo, or did you feel like you could, you had an idea of what was going to happen?
I mean, I knew of some of the risks around like feeling and such, and like nerve sensation, like around that area. And that there might be some, I think that limited movement came up a little bit. I mean, the thing was that I imagine that I think there's like lymph nodes or something in that area. And I don't remember anybody talking to me about that being removed or potentially being removed. It was just sort of weird because there wasn't any like descriptive, like, this is what's going to be actually removed from your body. Are you aware of that? It's very odd. I just felt like the surgeon, like when I was talking to her, I was like, you know, I was just expecting her to be more descriptive. Like she was very vague on things. So I feel like there was a lot of filling in the gaps. Like maybe she thought that I knew more than I did, but it was a very odd experience for sure.
And your visits prior to your surgery were all Zoom, right?
The one with the surgeon was in person, but okay. The other ones were Zoom.
Yeah.
Like the two mental health professionals, like one was a 50-minute appointment, if I remember right. And the other one was an hour. Like I remember one of them was not a full hour, which would seem odd for sure. Like, I mean, just not even meeting in person also would seem odd, but
yeah. I mean, yeah. I am grateful that telehealth exists. I think that it has a time and a place, but it does seem like we're kind of relying on it more and maybe using, you know, we used COVID as kind of a jumping off point for that. But it seems like certainly some of these visits really need to be, you need to touch a person. You need to have a connection with someone. You need to make sure that they're understanding everything, you know, and we're kind of just staring at screens. It's like, is this person receptive? Do they understand what's going on? Or, you know, and So did you have how was your surgery? Was it successful and did you feel better right away? Did you have any side effects, any complications from the surgery?
I had a lot of complications from the surgery. So like it was within days, I developed Raynaud's syndrome and which is when your capillaries shrink, you have issues with discoloration. And like I developed tinnitus right away, skin discoloration, bony prominences, like heat rashes. There were so many complications I developed after the surgery. It was very, and I remember that at first my doctors took me seriously because the very first thing was that I had issues with swallowing. So they took me, they got labs
swallowing?
For that.
Like
swallowing,
you
yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I had issues with swallowing first and then it was that. And then once, because there's this burning sensation on the back of my neck, and once they thought I had psychosomatic fever, then they stopped taking me seriously. So there was that really stark shift in how they treated me and their tone towards me after that. And I knew that my issues were physical. So I knew that that was how I needed to address this issue, because at this point I had done 20 years of traditional talk therapy, including EMDR. I'd done DBT, which is dialectical behavioral therapy, which is the standard for skill-based therapy. DBT or CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, or is it cognitive behavior therapy? I don't remember which, but one of those is another standard for a skill-based approach. Mm-hmm. And then I had done somatic experiencing hypnotherapy. I'd done two rounds of transcranial magnetic stimulation therapy, which is a cousin to electroconvulsive therapy, but much safer. So pretty much what they do with transcranial magnetic stimulation therapy is that they'll put a helmet on your head and they use magnets to stimulate your brain. And I did know a little bit of improvement, but it wasn't really where I needed to be. So at that point, I just knew, well, my doctors were telling me, go see a talk therapist. And I'm like, you know, I've done 20 years of this. Like at that point, I wanted to end everything because I knew that that wasn't the option. Like, that was not viable because I had done it for so long. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to have to figure this out. And so then I went the physical health route and I saw a naturopath and she started doing body work on me. And when she did Bowen, I was just like, oh, this is what I've needed for the last 20 years.
Wow.
And it was, and what Bowen is pretty much a manual type therapy of like you're gently pushing and pulling. But I think it's more maybe concise than and more like gentle than a traditional massage therapy, which is also another form of body work. And I don't know if trauma is stored in the muscles. I don't know if it's stored in the nervous system, but I noticed that I did start getting better mentally when I started doing these bodywork treatments. And then I started eating meat again after seeing Michaela Peterson. I'm like, wow, she seems stable. So I'm going to try what she's doing. And so I just didn't go full carnivore, but I did add meat back into my diet. So started doing that. I did find some success with grounding. I know that's personally one of them that I find a little bit more skeptical. I'm personally a little bit more skeptical of, but I do feel that it has helped and it doesn't hurt for me to do it. I have an earthing pad I sleep on every night. And then I did hyperbaric oxygen therapy. So for those of you who aren't familiar, hyperbaric oxygen therapy is when you receive pure oxygen in a pressurized environment. So I would wear a simple mask and then they would do, I think it's like an hour and 15 minutes, if I remember right. And it would be 20 minutes on with the mask and receiving the oxygen, 5 minutes off. And it was remarkable because I did 60 treatments. And so I did like a self-report scale for my anxiety and ADHD. And for my anxiety, I went from, I believe it was on the scale, moderate to mild. And my anxiety disorder, because I had generalized anxiety disorder, that went away. And then my ADHD went from 72 points to 6 points. Yeah. And so it was a remarkable treatment. And when I do hyperbaric oxygen therapy, my insomnia goes away, which is great. It has since come back. So I have to deal with insomnia now. But when I do the treatment, there's something about this treatment it's helping me sleep. And I've tried everything. So I don't know what it is about this treatment, but it's a remarkable form of treatment. And I would love to see it get out there more and people look at this more. I know I actually had CPTSD, which is complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And since I've done all these holistic treatments, that's also gone away. Hmm. So it's amazing. Like, I would have never expected that holistic health could address my mental health, because that's never been told to me through all my years of therapy and seeing doctors. It's really a new idea to me, for sure.
And so I guess that's kind of what you're promoting for folks, is alternative treatments to help deal with their gender dysphoria, so to speak, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we did talk to Grace for our movie, The Detransition Diaries, and she talked a lot too about her hips, you know, and how, and she was transitioning from, I think at first she was non-binary and then wanted to change from female to male, or, you know, attempt to. And so I just hear some of the things that you're saying about like your hips and, you know, kind of, it's making me think about her interview. Do you, in talking with other folks, is this kind of a common theme too? Like, as an advocate now for those who are detransitioning, we've talked about that being like a hard word, because I know Tulip on Twitter is like, you don't transition. There's no such thing. It's not, you know, it's surgery. And then, so I use that word lightly, but do you find that as like a common theme between folks who have similar experience to yours?
I think so, because I've heard Billy talk about it too. Who I've recently testified with, and I've testified with before, he was talking about how it's sort of this like you do one thing and then, well, now that I've done my, now that I've removed this part, now this part looks weird. So now I have to go work on that part. So it becomes this sort of like it's, I don't know how to describe it, but pretty much this sort of, well, this part, I did this part. Well, this part looks weird, so I have to do this part. Well, this part looks weird, now I have to go do that part. And this part looks weird, now I have to go do that part. So it's just this really unhealthy cycle of having, like, almost an ending cycle of having to fix things to match that idea in your head, you know, rather than be comfortable in your own skin. It's just like, well, if I could only do this, then I can be happy. Mm-hmm. Instead of, like, it's kind of reminds me of one of the best things a therapist has said to me is that he said, Camille, you're digging a hole, but you're digging it wider and you're not digging yourself out of it. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. And I think that with things like, you know, these surgeries, and also with my experience, because I had some bad experiences with, you know, being sold this idea of like, oh, you're depressed because of sexism, right? Instead of like, well, you're depressed because you're biologically dysfunctional and you're not getting the nutrients you need.
Right.
So
you keep seeking for this way. It seems like you keep seeking to find some sort of like balance, right? Like through all your therapy, right. And you're just striving to feel balanced, I guess.
Right. And it's sort of like the danger of that is like, and I think that sort of searching did get me eventually to physical health, but it can be somewhat tricky because if you go into something like, you know, these surgeries are through an ideology, the risk is that you're going to keep going through the ideology and you think that that's going to keep make you happy. Like that sort of striving for a better life can, you know, it's just like you're going to keep going for it and that's never going to be the solution. So I'd say like definitely the important thing is like have a strong foundation to kind of build yourself off of and go from there.
Yeah. And I think it's just really sad that folks can't trust the medical community to help guide them to find this balance and to find health mentally and physically. Instead, we're going to do surgeries that are irreversible. I mean, and now you have complications from a surgery on a part of your body that wasn't truly unhealthy. And now it is adding to something else, you know, adding to your health conditions that you may or may not have. And so it kind of is unnerving to think about that. Like instead of help restore your health, it's actually detrimental to your health.
Right. And that's really concerning to me because it is, you know, this is being put out there as a solution when they're not looking at other underlying issues. They're not saying, well, let's do the non-invasive thing first, or even something like a hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which I think depending on what type, it could potentially be comparable to a top surgery price. But, you know, something like hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which is non-invasive and can heal the whole body. And what's great about that is that, you know, my doctors didn't figure out what my underlying issues were, but this treatment just treats everything. So it's sort of like if your doctors can't figure out what's wrong, the body's just going to heal itself through a treatment like this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I love a treatment like that because it's just sort of a catch-all that it just takes care of you, like regardless. But
and it's good for wound healing, right? I feel like I'm remembering from my nursing school days that they do this for folks who have issues with wounds that aren't healing well, that really need like a lot more oxygen to help heal.
Exactly. And so it can be used for diabetics as well. So like diabetics are about to lose a limb, they can do it. And then also if you have sudden hearing loss, there's a potential to reverse it through hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Now, it doesn't always happen. Like I remember reading a case study about, and I didn't realize this, like the kid had taken methylphenidate, which I'm wondering if that's similar to what I was taking with methylphenidate CD. And this kid had sudden hearing loss. And unfortunately, the hyperbaric oxygen therapy was not able to reverse it. So, you know, it can have a potential to reverse hearing loss, but it's just, you know, and I'm not even sure what, you know, what, and I mean, that's what doctors want to know, right? Like, when is this going to actually help with hearing loss? And when is this not going to help with hearing loss? But I mean, it is a remarkable treatment though, and it's helped with my mental health so much.
So now that you're in this healthier state, what would you say, or how you support other folks who are going through detransition, but I also want to know how you think just the general population can help folks who are going through this. Like, what's needed? How can we help? I know I think just hearing the stories helps me understand. And I appreciate people like you who are willing to tell their story, because I think we need to know what's going on. But how else can we support folks who are struggling?
I think that one of the things that we could do is like you're saying, like getting the stories out there and actually hearing, like, what is the commonalities here that's allowing this to happen? I think the other thing is the testimonies. I know that that's what I've been doing, is that I've been going to different states and testifying for many of these bills that are stopping it from happening to children. That's where we're currently at right now. And, you know, because I think that's the first step is stopping this from happening to kids, and kind of going from there. And then also they hear my story and they hear that, well, even though, and I had these issues when I was a kid, I never grew out of it. And that's something people need to hear too. So then people are hearing that story. And also and I think this is another component, is having resources for detransitioners, because there's currently no doctors out there that are trained to work with us. And there's no protocol to address the issues that detransitioners are dealing with. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is unfortunate, because when we're looking at, you know, there's the gender affirming care model, right? So we have this, but we don't have any sort of model to deal with people who detransition. Like, there's no protocol, there's no set of things to detransition, there's no resources that help as much. I know that there's places like GenSpec and such, and that are trying to provide that, trying to set up a foundation, but there really isn't anything for us and out there. And I think that having access to, I really do think that alternative treatments like hyperbaric oxygen therapy, like diet, can really help detransitioners. But again, we're probably going to need case studies, and, you know, who's going to do the case studies for us? Because just trying to find doctors, I mean, I've talked to parents, and these functional medicine doctors want to prescribe testosterone, and they're not addressing, like, which is odd to me, because functional medicine doctors should be the ones that are kind of like, well, wait, let's address the underlying health issues first, mm-hmm. and then we can go from there.
Yeah.
But what's happening is that they know the patient has underlying health issues, and they're like, well, we can just give you testosterone. So they're not even the people who are on more of the alternative health side of things are kind of jumping the gun and, you know, going for testosterone and these surgeries instead of trying to address underlying health issues. So I think that's the big thing, is look at underlying health issues, make sure the person is stable, and don't let people in and go through these surgeries who are suicidal, because that's kind of been the argument of, well, you're suicidal, you must have these surgeries. And I was somebody who was struggling with suicidal ideation, but that's definitely not a valid thing to just send somebody off when they're struggling in that way. So,
well, you wouldn't perform an operation on someone that wasn't, you know, life, you know, necessary. So I'm just thinking of mm-hmm. people need to be in kind of, you know, decent shape to have surgery sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, they don't put someone under anesthesia who's having X, Y, and Z issue. You know, it's like, let's deal with that first. Let's get you stable. And then we'll go have surgery. And that should be the same mentally too. Like, let's get mentally stable. Let's figure out the issue and then, and work from there. Yeah. And it's like you said, there's no one to treat, or it seems like there's no one to treat folks who are now on the other side of this. And do you think, I think it could be because the gender identity or the gender industry is kind of scary, right? Mm-hmm. Like we don't have a lot of physicians and therapists who are going up against it because mm-hmm. they could be canceled and because their livelihood depends on it. And so I can understand why we don't see people treating those who are detransitioning, but we need people to stand up to this. Like, we need it. Lives depend on it. You know, we need doctors and therapists who stand up to this industry. Yeah. Do you have anything else you'd like to add just about the industry as a whole? Like, and actually, I'm not going to ask that question. I'd like to jump back to, you talked about how you testify about laws that are coming out. Could you speak to like one or two of maybe that you've testified at hearings for? Because I don't think two people understand how this industry is invading laws around the United States and abroad. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, so pretty much I testified for the Florida Board of Medicine twice. And then I also testified in South Dakota and in Montana. So I've done a couple of testimonies, and they were focused on like, and they're going to be a little bit different, the bills, but pretty much the general idea is not performing these surgeries and giving hormone replacement therapy to minors. So that's going to be the basis of these bills.
Sure. And minor under 18, yeah. Is that kind of the safe? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So under 18, they're not going to perform these surgeries. There was kind of like in Florida, it was interesting because from my understanding, they kind of made an exception with one of their medical boards, but the medical board, like it would have been that they can still do like university like research, but that sort of thing. I don't know if that makes sense, but pretty much that the research couldn't be done because this type of medicine board doesn't do that type of research. So that's what I thought was kind of interesting, was that they were kind of frustrated because the ones that would be doing the research were like, no, we're just not going to do this at all. Because they talked about the Dutch study and how the Dutch study, that mental illness was not a factor at all. So they made sure that people weren't emotionally dysfunctional who were getting these surgeries, and they had a high dropout rate. So it wasn't good. And I think it was the checkup time was very short too. And then they've followed up since then. It's just, it's a lot more complicated than what the original study suggested. So I think that it's probably going to depend state on state, but the main thing is that stopping this, because we've gone too far with this and nobody's like figuring out, like there's no, I mean, that's the thing, is that doctors aren't following up. Like, no one's ever followed up with me to make sure that I was okay.
Wow.
So it's just, this is such a new thing, and we're not getting the research on detransitioners. So it's important that we just kind of, you know, as much as possible, kind of like put a hold and definitely stop it from happening to kids. So, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have hope? Do you think that this industry is stoppable?
I hope that it goes through. I do have some concern from different states, because for the states like California, this is going to be an issue. But people who, like states that are a little bit more grounded and people who are more open to hearing things and more logical, they're like, this doesn't seem right. Like even like people I talk to who are left-leaning, like they hear about this and they're like, no, there's something off here. Like, we need to stop this. So I think that there is hope. My concern is going to be for the states like California, like Oregon, which is the state I live in. So I am worried about Oregon, but I do have hope, especially for the majority of these states, that they will put an end to this.
Yeah, I hope so too. Gosh, for kids, right? Like this is this is really important. And I'm really grateful for people like you who are willing to talk and say, hey, hold up. This wasn't, how long after your surgery did it take you to realize like, okay, I'm not non-binary. I am a woman. And, and this was a mistake.
It took me about a year and a half. So, and that's the thing too. Yeah. That some people figure it out right away. And I remember that when my surgeon took the bandages off right after the surgery, it would have been, well, a couple weeks after the surgery or a month after the surgery, she took the bandages off and I looked in the mirror and I had such mixed feelings. Like it wasn't this, oh my gosh, that's it. Like I just looked at it and I felt that she had done the surgery for me. So I thanked her for it. Like I was like, I need to make her happy because she did all this work for me and I need to thank her. And so that was kind of my mindset at the time, but even back then, I mean, there was probably the start of it. And I remember thinking, I was like, I'm so grateful for it. But then there's sort of like this, like, well, I feel kind of mixed about the surgery, but it was this sort of weird thing. And it wasn't until I started addressing the physical health issues and started getting more stable that I realized that, wow, like this wasn't what I needed. Like I just needed to address my physical health. So,
right. Well, even the fact that after the surgery, you were like, okay, this didn't fix it. Like, I'm still looking for something to fix it. You know, like I still don't feel right. Like, even though you couldn't pinpoint it, you were still looking for health and wellness. Were your parents supportive? I find that in this fight against the industry, I feel like the parents, like not only do we need physicians and healthcare workers to stand up and say, kind of put their neck on the line and say, I don't support this. This isn't right. But I think parents are also super valuable in this fight. Parents who are showing up to board meetings, parents who are showing up to their schools, parents who are showing up and helping protect their children. So how are your parents? And if you don't want to answer that, that's fine, because I don't want you to put you in any type of situation. But
yeah, so my parents were supportive both ways. They supported me when I transitioned and they supported me when I detransitioned. So they were supportive. I think that part of the issue is that, you know, we've been taught that this is being accepting towards people, and then we don't want to be discriminatory. We don't want to hurt people. And I think that this is coming out of a place, like many people are meaning well in this. But the thing is that they're not addressing the underlying issues. And that's the big thing, is that this has been passed through and it's not the same thing as being gay. And I think that that's important as well, is that I remember two of my therapists saying this to me. So they said, you must be non-binary because we used to think being gay was a form of mental illness. So there's this sort of like odd comparison of you being non-binary, which is this gender that doesn't exist, must be legitimate because we used to think being gay was a form of mental illness. So we can't say this thing over here, which has no biological equivalent in nature, that this must be legitimate because this other thing we used to not think is legitimate and we thought was mental illness. So
but you didn't have to chop off your breast to be gay, you know?
Right. Like, exactly.
You didn't have to tie into this to do that, you know? So
yeah, and I think that's the good point. Like it's not that it doesn't require medicalization to be gay. It does not require that, versus it requires medicalization to be trans. Like, I mean, I know theories out there about like, well, we shouldn't have to do anything to be trans or whatever, but on the most part, being trans requires medicalization. And so Yeah, it's just concerning because it's this like false equivalency, mm-hmm. but cannot speak. But pretty much it's, you know, it's not, those two things aren't equal for sure.
Yeah. And I follow an account on Instagram that kind of speaks to that. They're against, it's the LGB population that is kind of fighting against the transing of children. So another important voice. All of us need to work together to kind of stop this crazy, big, terrible ideology. But our time, Camille, is wrapping up. So is there anything at all that you would like to say? Is there a place people can follow you? Are you active on social media? I know some people, this is a lot to take on. And so yeah. They kind of step away from social media for a while, which I completely understand. But is there a way people can follow you or anything else you'd like to add to our listeners?
Yeah, so I have a YouTube channel, The Get Better Researcher. I also get better tweets on Twitter. I also have an All My Links, which has, you know, alternative platforms like Rumble. And that should be something like allmylinks.com/Camille Kiefel or something. So okay. You can find me there.
Great, great. Thank you again. It has been a privilege to have you on the show. And I thank you for your advocacy in this arena. And thank you for taking the time to chat with me about this and share your story on Venus Rising.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I'd like to also thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in and listening to Camille. Our goal, as ever, is to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you all to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell. Have an excellent week.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.